Chapter 6 Before the Storm 1 Rising up from the darkness, dolorous and accusatory, came the voice of Henry Dean, the great sage and eminent junkie.
"I'm in hell, bro. I'm in hell, and I can't get a fix, and it's all your fault. How long will we have to be here, do you think?"
Eddie asked Callahan. They had just reached the doorway cave, and the great sage's little bro was already shaking a pair of bullets in his right hand, like dice, 7 come 11, baby need a little peace and quiet. It was the day after the big meeting, and when Eddie and the pair had ridden out of town, the high street had seemed unusually quiet. It was almost as if the collar was hiding from itself, overwhelmed by what it had committed itself to.
"I'm afraid it'll be a while," Callahan admitted.
He was neatly and nondescriptly, he hoped, dressed. In the breast pocket of his shirt was all the American money they'd been able to put together, 11 crumpled dollars and a pair of quarters. He thought it would be a bitter joke if he turned up in a version of America where Lincoln was on the single and Washington on the 50s.
"But we can do it in stages, I think."
"Thank God for small favors," Eddie said, and dragged the pink bag out from behind Tower's bookcase.
He lifted it with both hands, began to turn, then stopped. He was frowning.
"What is it?"
Callahan asked.
"There's something in here."
"Yes, the box."
"No, something in the bag. Sewn into the lining, I think. It feels like a little rock. Maybe there's a secret pocket."
"And maybe," Callahan said, "this isn't the time to investigate it."
Still, Eddie gave the object another small squeeze. It didn't feel like a stone, exactly, but Callahan was probably right. They had enough mysteries on their hands already. This one was for another day. When Eddie slid the ghostwood box out of the bag, a sick dread invaded both his head and his heart.
"I hate this thing. I keep feeling like it's going to turn on me and eat me like a taco chip." "It probably could," Callahan said. "If you feel something really bad happening, Eddie, shut the damn thing. Your ass would be stuck on the other side if I did."
"It's not as though I'm a stranger there,"
Callahan said, eyeing the unfound door. Eddie heard his brother. Callahan heard his mother, endlessly hectoring, calling him Donnie. He'd always hated being called Donnie.
"I'll just wait for it to open again."
Eddie stuffed the bullets into his ears.
"Why are you letting him do that, Donnie?"
Callahan's mother moaned from the darkness.
"Bullets in your ears, that's dangerous." "Go on," Eddie said. "Get it done."
He opened the box. The chimes attacked Callahan's ears, and his heart. The door to everywhere clicked open. 2. He went through thinking about two things. The year 1977, and the men's room on the main floor of the New York Public Library. He stepped into a bathroom stall with graffiti on the walls. Bango Skank had been there, and the sound of a flushing urinal somewhere to his left. He waited for whoever it was to leave, then stepped out of the stall. It took him only 10 minutes to find what he needed. When he stepped back through the door into the cave, he was holding a book under his arm. He asked Eddie to step outside with him and didn't have to ask twice. In the fresh air and breezy sunshine, the previous night's clouds had blown away, Eddie took the bullets from his ears and examined the book. It was called Yankee Highways.
"The father's a library thief," Eddie remarked. "You're exactly the sort of person who makes the fees go up." "I'll return it some day," Callahan said. He meant it. "The important thing is I got lucky on my second try. Check page 119.
Eddie did. The photograph showed a stark, white church sitting on a hill above a dirt road. East Stoneham Methodist Meeting Hall, the caption said. Built 1819. Eddie thought, Adam? Come out with 19, of course. He mentioned this to Callahan, who smiled and nodded.
"Notice anything else?"
Of course he did.
"It looks like the collar gathering hall." "So it does. It's twin, almost."
Callahan took a deep breath.
"Are you ready for round two?"
"I guess so."
"This one's apt to be longer, but you should be able to pass the time. There's plenty of reading matter."
"I don't think I could read,"
Eddie said. I'm too fucking nervous, pardon my French. Maybe I'll see what's in the lining of the bag.
But Eddie forgot about the object in the lining of the pink bag. It was Susanna who eventually found that. And when she did, she was no longer herself. 3. Thinking 1977, and holding the book open to the picture of the Methodist meeting hall in East Stoneham, Callahan stepped through the unfound door for the second time. He came out on a brilliantly sunny New England morning. The church was there, but it had been painted since its picture had been taken for Yankee Highways, and the road had been paved. Sitting nearby was a building that hadn't been in the photo, the East Stoneham General Store. Good. He walked down there, followed by the floating doorway, reminding himself not to spend one of the quarters which had come from his own little stash unless he absolutely had to. The one from Jake was dated 1969, which was okay. His, however, was from 1981, and that wasn't. As he walked past the mobile gas pumps, where regular was selling for 49 cents a gallon, he transferred it to his back pocket. When he entered the store, which smelled almost exactly like Took's, a bell jingled. To the left was a stack of Portland Press Heralds, and the date gave him a nasty little shock. When he'd taken the book from the New York Public Library not half an hour ago by his body's clock, it had been June 26th. The date on these papers was the 27th. He took one, reading the headlines, A Flood in New Orleans, The Usual Unrest Among the Homicidal Idiots of the Mideast, and noting the price, a dime. Good. He'd get change back from his 69 quarter. Maybe buy a piece of good old made-in-the-USA salami. The clerk looked him over with a cheerful eye as he approached the counter.
That do it? He asked. Well, I tell you what, Callahan said, I could use a point toward the post office if that does you.
The clerk raised an eyebrow and smiled.
You sound like you're from these parts.
Do you say so, then? Callahan asked, also smiling.
Yeah. Anyway, post office is easy. Ain't but a mile down this road on your left.
He pronounced road, rud, exactly as Jamie Jaffords might have done.
Good enough. And do you sell salami by the slice? I'll sell it just about any old way you want to buy it,
the clerk said amiably.
Summer visitor, are you?
It came out summer visitor, and Callahan almost expected him to add, tell me, I beg.
You could call me that, I guess, Callahan said.
4. In the cave, Eddie fought against the faint but maddening jangle of the chimes and peered through the half-open door. Callahan was walking down a country road. Goody gumdrops for him. Meantime, maybe Mrs. Dean's little boy would try having himself a bit of a read. With a cold and slightly trembling hand, he reached into the bookcase and pulled out a volume two down from one that had been turned upside down, one that would certainly have changed his day had he happened to grab it. What he came up with instead was 4 short novels of Sherlock Holmes.
Ah, Holmes, another great sage and eminent junkie.
Eddie opened to A Study in Scarlet and began to read. Every now and then he found himself looking down at the box where Black 13 pulsed out its weird force. He could just see a curve of glass. After a little bit, he gave up trying to read, only looking at the curve of glass, growing more and more fascinated. But the chimes were fading, and that was good, wasn't it? After a little while, he could hardly hear them at all. A little while after that, a voice crept past the bullets in his ears and began to speak to him. Eddie listened. 5.
Pardon me, ma'am.
Yeah?
The postmistress was a woman in her late 50s or early 60s, dressed to meet the public with hair of a perfect beauty shop blue-white.
I'd like to leave a letter for some friends of mine, Callahan said. They're from New York, and they'd likely be general delivery customers.
He had argued with Eddie that Calvin Tower, on the run from a bunch of dangerous hoods who would almost certainly still want his head on a stick, wouldn't do anything so dumb as sign up for mail.
Eddie had reminded him of how Tower had been about his fucking precious first editions, and Callahan had finally agreed to at least try this.
Summer folk?
Do ya? Callahan agreed, but that wasn't quite right. I mean, Their names are Calvin Tower and Aaron Deepno. I guess that isn't information you're supposed to give someone just in off the street, but...
Oh, we don't bother much about such things out in these parts, she said.
Parts came out pots.
Just let me check the list. We have so many between Memorial Day and Labor Day.
She picked up a clipboard with three or four tattered sheets of paper on it from her side of the counter. Lots of handwritten names. She flicked over the first sheet to the second, then from the second to the third.
Deepno, she said. There's that one. Now, just let me see if I can find t'other one.
Never mind, Callahan said. All at once he felt uneasy, as though something had gone wrong back on the other side. He glanced over his shoulder and saw nothing but the door and the cave and Eddie sitting there cross-legged with a book in his lap.
Got somebody chasing you?
The postlady asked, smiling. Callahan laughed. It sounded forced and stupid to his own ears, but the postlady seemed to sense nothing wrong.
If I were to write Aaron a note and put it in a stamped envelope, would you see that he gets it when he comes in? Or when Mr. Tower comes in?
Oh, no need to buy a stamp, said she comfortably. Glad to do it.
Yes. It was like the collar. Suddenly, he liked this woman very much, liked her big, big. Callahan went to the counter by the window, the door doing a neat do-si-do around him when he turned, and jotted a note, first introducing himself as a friend of the man who had helped Tower with Jack Andolini. He told Deepno and Tower to leave their car where it was and to leave some of the lights on in the place where they were staying, and then to move somewhere close by. A barn, an abandoned camp, even a shed. To do it immediately, leave a note with directions to where you are under the driver's side floor mat of your car, or under the back porch step, he wrote. We'll be in touch. He hoped he was doing this right. They hadn't talked things out this far, and he'd never expected to have to do any cloak and dagger stuff. He signed, as Roland had told him to, Callahan of the Eld. Then, in spite of his growing unease, he added another line, almost slashing the letters into the paper. And make this trip to the post office your last. How stupid can you be? He put the note in an envelope, sealed it, and wrote Aaron Deepno or Calvin Tower, general delivery, on the front. He took it back to the counter.
I'll be happy to buy a stamp, he told her again.
Nope, just 2 cents for the envelope and we're square.
He gave her the nickel left over from the store, took back his 3 cents change, and headed for the door, the ordinary one.
Good luck to you, the postlady called.
Callahan turned his head to look at her and say thanks. He caught a glimpse of the unfound door when he did, still open. What he didn't see was Eddie. 6. Callahan turned to that strange door as soon as he was outside the post office. Ordinarily, you couldn't do that. Ordinarily, it swung with you as neatly as a square dance partner, but it seemed to know when you intended to step back through. Then you could face it. The minute he was back, the toad ash chimes seized him, seeming to etch patterns on the surface of his brain. From the bowels of the cave, his mother cried,
"There now, Donnie, you've gone and let that nice boy commit suicide. He'll be in Pergy forever, and it's your fault."
Callahan barely heard. He dashed to the mouth of the cave, still carrying the Press Herald he'd bought in the East Stoneham General Store, under one arm. There was just time to see why the box hadn't closed, leaving him a prisoner in East Stoneham, Maine, circa 1977. There was a thick book sticking out of it. Callahan even had time to read the title, Four Short Novels of Sherlock Holmes. Then he burst out into sunshine. At first he saw nothing but the boulder on the path leading up to the mouth of the cave, and was sickeningly sure his mother's voice had told the truth. Then he looked left and saw Eddie 10 feet away, at the end of the narrow path and tottering on the edge of the drop. His untucked shirt fluttered around the butt of Roland's big revolver. His normally sharp and rather foxy features now looked puffy and blank. It was the dazed face of a fighter out on his feet. His hair blew around his ears. He swayed forward,
Then his mouth tightened, and his eyes became almost aware. He grasped an outcrop of rock and swayed back again. "He's fighting it," Callahan thought. "And I'm sure he's fighting the good fight, but he's losing." Calling out might actually send him over the edge. Callahan knew this with a gunslinger's intuition, always sharpest and most dependable in times of crisis. Instead of yelling, he sprinted up the remaining stub of path and wound a hand in the tail of Eddie's shirt just as Eddie swayed forward again, this time removing his hand from the outcrop beside him and using it to cover his eyes in a gesture that was unmeaningly comic. "Goodbye, cruel world." If the shirt had torn, Eddie Dean would undoubtedly have been excused from Ka's great game. But perhaps even the tails of homespun Kala Brynsturgis shirts, for that was what he was wearing, served Ka. In any case, the shirt didn't tear, and Callahan had held on to a great part of the physical strength he had built up during his years on the road. He yanked Eddie back and caught him in his arms, but not before the younger man's head struck the outcrop his hand had been on a few seconds before. His lashes fluttered, and he looked at Callahan with a kind of stupid unrecognition. He said something that sounded like gibberish to Callahan.
"Say, I can fly this hour."
Callahan grabbed his shoulders and shook him.
"What? I don't understand you."
Nor did he much want to, but he had to make some kind of contact, had to bring Eddie back from wherever the accursed thing in the box had taken him.
"I don't understand you."
This time the response was clearer.
"It says I can fly to the tower. You can let me go. I want to go."
"You can't fly, Eddie." He wasn't sure that got through, so he put his head down all the way until he and Eddie were resting brow to brow like lovers.
"It was trying to kill you." "No,"
Eddie began, and then awareness came all the way back into his eyes. An inch from Callahan's own, they widened in understanding.
"Yes."
Callahan lifted his head, but still kept a prudent grip on Eddie's shoulders.
"Are you all right now?"
"Yeah, I guess so, at least. I was going along good, Father, swear I was. I mean, the chimes were doing a number on me, but otherwise I was fine. I even grabbed a book and started to read."
He looked around.
"Jesus, I hope I didn't lose it. Tower'll scalp me."
"You didn't lose it. You stuck it partway into the box. And it's a damn good thing you did, otherwise the door would have shut and you'd be strawberry jam about 700 feet down."
Eddie looked over the edge and went completely pale. Callahan had just time enough to regret his frankness before Eddie vomited on his new shore boots. 7.
"It crept up on me, Father," he said when he could talk. "Lulled me and then jumped."
"Yes.
Did you get anything at all out of your time over there?"
"If they get my letter and do what it says, a great deal. You were right. Deepno at least signed up for general delivery. About Tower, I don't know."
Callahan shook his head angrily.
"I think we're going to find that Tower talked Deepno into it," Eddie said. "Cal Tower still can't believe what he's gotten himself into. And after what just happened to me, almost happened to me, I've got some sympathy for that kind of thinking."
He looked at what Callahan still had clamped under one arm.
"What's that?"
"The newspaper,"
Callahan said, and offered it to Eddie.
"Care to read about Golda Meir?"
8. Roland listened carefully that evening as Eddie and Callahan recounted their adventures in the doorway cave and beyond. The gunslingers seemed less interested in Eddie's near-death experience than he was in the similarities between Kala Brynsturgis and East Stoneham. He even asked Callahan to imitate the accent of the storekeeper and the postlady. This Callahan, a former Maine resident, after all, was able to do quite well.
"Do ya?" said Roland, and then, "Aya? Do ya, Aya?"
He sat thinking, one boot heel cocked up on the rail of the rectory porch.
"Will they be okay for a while, do you think?" Eddie asked.
"I hope so," Roland replied.
"If you want to worry about someone's life, worry about Deep Nose. If Balazar hasn't given up on the vacant lot, he has to keep Tower alive. Deep Nose, nothing but a watch me chip now.
Can we leave them until after the wolves?"
"I don't see what choice we have."
"We could drop this whole business and go over there to East Overshoe and protect him," Eddie said heatedly. "How about that? Listen, Roland, I'll tell you exactly why Tower talked his friend into signing up for general delivery. Somebody's got a book he wants, that's why. He was dickering for it, and negotiations had reached the delicate stage when I showed up and persuaded him to head for the hills. But Tower, man, he's like a chimp with a handful of grain. He won't let go. If Balazar knows that, and he probably does, he won't need a zip code to find his men, just a list of the people Tower did business with. I hope to Christ that if there was a list, it burned up in the fire.
Roland was nodding. I understand, but we can't leave here. We're promised.
Eddie thought it over, sighed, and shook his head. What the hell? 3.5 more days over here, 17 over there before the deal letter Tower signed expires. Things will probably hold together that long. He paused, biting his lip.
Maybe.
Is maybe the best we can do? Callahan asked.
Yeah, Eddie said. For the time being, I guess it is.
9. The following morning, a badly frightened Susanna Dean sat in the privy at the foot of the hill, bent over, waiting for her current cycle of contractions to pass. She'd been having them for a little over a week now, but these were by far the strongest. She put her hands on her lower belly. The flesh there was alarmingly hard.
Oh, dear God, what if I'm having it right now? What if this is it?
She tried to tell herself this couldn't be it. Her water hadn't broken, and you couldn't go into genuine labor until that happened. But what did she actually know about having babies? Very little. Even Rosalita Munoz, a midwife of great experience, wouldn't be able to help her much, because Rosa's career had been delivering human babies of mothers who actually looked pregnant. Susanna looked less pregnant now than when they'd first arrived in the Cala. And if Roland was right about this baby,
it's not a baby. It's a chap, and it doesn't belong to me. It belongs to Mia, whoever she is. Mia, daughter of none.
The cramps ceased. Her lower belly relaxed, losing that stony feel. She laid a finger along the cleft of her vagina. It felt the same as ever. Surely she was going to be all right for another few days. She had to be. And while she'd agreed with Roland that there should be no more secrets in their quartet, she felt she had to keep this one. When the fighting finally started, it would be 7 against 40 or 50. Maybe as many as 70 if the wolves stuck together in a single pack. They would have to be at their very best, their most fiercely concentrated. That meant no distractions. It also meant that she must be there to take her place. She yanked up her jeans, did the buttons, and went out into the bright sunshine, absently rubbing at her left temple. She saw the new lock on the privy, just as Roland had asked, and began to smile. Then she looked down at her shadow, and the smile froze. When she'd gone into the privy, her dark lady had stretched out 9 in the morning long. Now she was saying that if noon wasn't here, it would be shortly.
That's impossible. I was only in there a few minutes, long enough to pee.
Perhaps that was true. Perhaps it was Mia who had been in there the rest of the time.
No, she said. That can't be so. But Susanna thought it was.
Mia wasn't ascendant, not yet, but she was rising. Getting ready to take over, if she could.
Please, she prayed, putting one hand out against the privy wall to brace herself. Just 3 more days. God, give me 3 more days as myself. Let us do our duty to the children of this place, and then what you will. Whatever you will, but please, just 3 more, she murmured. And if they do us down out there, it won't matter no way. 3 more days, God. Hear me, I beg.
10.
A day later, Eddie and Tian Jaffords went looking for Andy, and came upon him standing by himself at the wide and dusty junction of East and River Roads, singing at the top of his...
Nope. Eddie said as he and Tian approached. Can't say lungs. He doesn't have lungs.
Cry pardon? Tian asked.
Nothing, Eddie said. Doesn't matter.
But by the process of association, lungs to general anatomy, a question had occurred to him. Tien, is there a doctor in the Kala? Tien looked at him with surprise and some amusement.
Not us, Eddie. Gut-tossers might do well for rich folks who have the time to go and the money to pay, but when us get sick, we go to one of the sisters.
The sisters of Oriza.
Yeah, if the medicine's good, it usually be, we get better. If it ain't, we get worse. In the end, the ground cures all, do you see?
Yes, Eddie said, thinking how difficult it must be for them to fit ruined children into such a view of things. Those who came back ruined died eventually, but for years they just lingered.
There's only 3 boxes to a man, Eniro, Tien said as they approached the solitary singing robot.
Off in the eastern distance between Calibrin Sturgis and Thunderclap, Eddie could see scarves of dust rising toward the blue sky, although it was perfectly still where they were.
Boxes? I say true, Tien said, then rapidly touched his brow, his breast, and his butt. Head box, tit box, shit box. And he laughed heartily.
You say that? Eddie asked, smiling.
Well, out here between us, it does fine, Tien said, although I guess no proper lady'd hear the boxes so described at her table.
He touched his head, chest, and bottom again.
Thought box, heart box, key box.
Eddie heard key.
What's that last one mean? What kind of key unlocks your ass?
Tien stopped. They were in plain view of Andy, but the robot ignored them completely, singing what sounded like opera in a language Eddie couldn't understand. Every now and then, Andy held his arms up or crossed them, the gestures seemingly part of the song he was singing.
"Hear me," Tien said kindly. "A man is stacked, do you ken? On top is his thoughts, which is the finest part of a man."
"Or a woman," Eddie said, smiling. Tien nodded seriously. "Aye, or a woman, but we use man to stand for both, because woman was born of man's breath, Kennet."
"Do you say so?" Eddie asked, thinking of some women's lib types he'd met before leaving New York for Midworld. He doubted they'd care for that idea much more than for the part of the Bible that said Eve had been made from Adam's rib.
"Let it be so," Tien agreed. "But it was Lady Oriza who gave birth to the first man, so the old folks will tell you. They say Kana, Kanta, Anna, Oriza. All breath comes from the woman.
So tell me about these boxes.
Best and highest is the head, with all the head's ideas and dreams. Next is the heart, with all our feelings of love and sadness and joy and happiness.
The emotions."
Tien looked both puzzled and respectful.
"Do you say so?"
"Well, where I come from, we do, so let it be so."
"Ah,"
Tien nodded as if the concept were interesting, but only borderline comprehensible. This time, instead of touching his bottom, he patted his crotch.
"In the last box is all what we'd call low Kamala. Have a fuck, take a shit, maybe want to do someone a meanness for no reason."
"And if you do have a reason?"
"Ah, but then it wouldn't be meanness, would it?"
Tien asked, looking amused.
"In that case, it'd come from the heart box or the head box."
"That's bizarre," Eddie said, but he supposed it wasn't, not really. In his mind's eye, he could see 3 neatly stacked crates. Head on top of heart, heart on top of all the animal functions and groundless rages people sometimes felt. He was particularly fascinated by Tien's use of the word meanness, as if it were some kind of behavioral landmark. Did that make sense or didn't it? He would have to consider it carefully, and this wasn't the time. Andy still stood gleaming in the sun, pouring out great gusts of song. Eddie had a vague memory of some kids back in the neighborhood yelling out, "I'm the barber of Sevilla, you must try my fucking skill," and then running away, laughing like loons as they went.
"Andy," Eddie said, and the robot broke off at once. "Hi, Eddie, I see you well. Long days and pleasant nights."
"Same to you," Eddie said. "How are you?"
"Fine, Eddie," Andy said fervently. "I always enjoy singing before the first Seminon."
"Seminon?"
"It's what we call the windstorms that come before true winter," Tien said, and pointed to the clouds of dust far beyond the Y. "Yonder comes the first one. It'll be here either the day of wolves or the day after, I judge.
The day of, Si, said Andy. Seminon comin', warm days go runnin', so they say.
He bent toward Eddie. Clickings came from inside his gleaming head. His blue eyes flashed on and off.
Eddie, I have cast a great horoscope, very long and complex, and it shows victory against the wolves. A great victory, indeed. You will vanquish your enemies and then meet a beautiful lady.
I already have a beautiful lady, Eddie said, trying to keep his voice pleasant. He knew perfectly well what those rapidly flashing blue lights meant. The son of a bitch was laughing at him.
Well, he thought, maybe you'll be laughing on the other side of your face a couple of days from now, Andy. I certainly hope so.
So you do, but many a married man has had his jilly, as I told Si Tian Jeffords not so long ago.
Not those who love their wives, Tian said. I told you so then, and I tell you now.
Andy, old buddy, Eddie said earnestly, we came out here in hopes that you'd do us a solid on the night before the wolves come. Help us a little, you know?
There were several clicking sounds deep in Andy's chest, and this time when his eyes flashed, they almost seemed alarmed.
I would if I could, Si, Andy said. Oh, yes, there's nothing I like more than helping my friends, but there are a great many things I can't do, much as I might like to.
Because of your programming.
Aye.
The smug, so happy to see you tone had gone out of Andy's voice. He sounded more like a machine now. Yeah, that's his fallback position, Eddie thought. That's Andy being careful. You've seen him come and go, haven't you, Andy? Sometimes they call you a useless bag of bolts, and mostly they ignore you, but either way, you end up walking over their bones and singing your songs, don't you? But not this time, pal. No, I don't think so.
When were you built, Andy? I'm curious. When did you roll off the old Lamerck assembly line?
Long ago, Si, the blue eyes flashing very slowly now. Not laughing anymore.
2,000 years? Longer, I believe. Si, I know a song about drinking that you might like. It's very amusing.
Maybe another time. Listen, good buddy. If you're thousands of years old, how is it that you're programmed concerning the wolves?
From inside Andy there came a deep, reverberant clunk, as though something had broken. When he spoke again, it was in the dead, emotionless voice Eddie had first heard on the edge of Midforest, the voice of Bosco Bob when old Bosco was getting ready to cloud up and rain all over you.
"What's your password, Si Eddie? Think we've been down this road before, haven't we? Password, you have 10 seconds. 9, 8, 7. That password shit's very convenient for you, isn't it?
Incorrect password, Si Eddie.
Kinda like taking the 5th. 2, 1, 0. You may retry once. Would you retry, Eddie?
Eddie gave him a sunny smile. Does a Seminon blow in the summertime, old buddy? More clicks and clacks. Andy's head, which had been tilted one way, now tilted the other.
I do not follow you, Eddie of New York.
Sorry, I'm just being a silly old human being, aren't I? No, I don't want to retry, at least not right now. Let me tell you what we'd like you to help us with, and you can tell us if your programming will allow you to do it. Does that sound fair?
Fair as fresh air, Eddie.
Okay. Eddie reached up and took hold of Andy's thin metal arm. The surface was smooth and somehow unpleasant to the touch. Greasy. Oily. Eddie held on nonetheless and lowered his voice to a confidential level.
I'm only telling you this because you're clearly good at keeping secrets.
Oh, yes, Si, Eddie. No one keeps a secret like Andy.
The robot was back on solid ground and back to his old self, smug and complacent.
Well, Eddie went up on tiptoe, bend down here.
Servo motors hummed inside Andy's casing. Inside what would have been his heart box, had he not been a high-tech tin man. He bent down. Eddie, meanwhile,
stretched up even further, feeling absurdly like a small boy telling a secret.
"The pair's got some guns from our level of the tower," he murmured. "Good ones."
Andy's head swiveled around. His eyes glared out with a brilliance that could only have been astonishment. Eddie kept a poker face, but inside he was grinning.
"Say true, Eddie."
"Say thank you."
"Pear says they're powerful," Tian said. "If they work, we can use them to blow the living bugger out of the wolves. But we have to get them out north of town, and they're heavy. Can you help us load them in a bucca on Wolf's Eve, Andy?"
Silence. Clicks and clacks.
"Programming won't let him, I bet," Eddie said sadly. "Well, if we get enough strong backs—"
"I can help you," Andy said. "Where are these guns, Size?"
"Better not say just now," Eddie replied. "You meet us at the Pear's rectory early on Wolf's Eve, all right?"
"What hour would you have me?"
"How does 6 sound?"
6 o' the clock. And how many guns will there be? Tell me that much at least, so I may calculate the required energy levels."
"My friend, it takes a bullshitter to recognize bullshit," Eddie thought merrily, but kept a straight face.
"There be 12, maybe 15. They weigh 200 pounds each. Do you know pounds, Andy?"
"Aye, say thank you. A pound is roughly 450 grams, 16 ounces. A pint's a pound the world around. Those are big guns, Si, Eddie, say true. Will they shoot?"
"We're pretty sure they will," Eddie said. "Aren't we, Tian?"
Tian nodded.
"And you'll help us?" "Aye, happy to. 6 o' the clock at the rectory."
"Thank you, Andy," Eddie said. He started away, then looked back. "You absolutely won't talk about this, will you?"
"No, Si, not if you tell me not to."
"That's just what I'm telling you. The last thing we want is for the wolves to find out we've got some big guns to use against them."
"Of course not," Andy said. "What good news this is. Have a wonderful day, Size."
"And you, Andy," Eddie replied. "And you."
11. Walking back toward Tian's place, it was only 2 miles distant from where they'd come upon Andy, Tian said, "Does he believe it?"
"I don't know," Eddie said, "but it surprised the shit out of him. Did you feel that?"
"Yes," Tian said. "Yes, I did."
"He'll be there to see for himself, I guarantee that much."
Tian nodded, smiling.
"Your Din is clever."
"That he is," Eddie agreed. "That he is."
12. Once more Jake lay awake, looking up at the ceiling of Benny's room. Once more Oi lay on Benny's bed, curved into a comma with his nose beneath his squiggle of tail. Tomorrow night Jake would be back at Father Callahan's, back with his quartet, and he couldn't wait. Tomorrow would be Wolf's Eve, but this was only the eve of Wolf's Eve, and Roland had felt it would be best for Jake to stay this one last night at the Rocking Bee. "We don't want to raise suspicions this late in the game," he'd said. Jake understood, but boy, this was sick. The prospect of standing against the wolves was bad enough. The thought of how Benny might look at him 2 days from now was even worse.
"Maybe we'll all get killed," Jake thought. "Then I won't have to worry about it."
In his distress, this idea actually had a certain attraction.
"Jake? You asleep?"
For a moment, Jake considered faking it, but something inside sneered at such cowardice.
"No," he said. "But I ought to try, Benny. I doubt if I'll get much tomorrow night."
"I guess not,"
Benny whispered back respectfully, and then,
"You scared?"
"Course I am," Jake said.
"What do you think I am, crazy?"
Benny got up on one elbow.
"How many do you think you'll kill?"
Jake thought about it. It made him sick to think about it, way down in the pit of his stomach, but he thought about it anyway.
"Don't know. If there's 70, I guess I'll have to try to get 10. He found himself thinking, with a mild sense of wonder, of Miss Avery's English class. The hanging yellow globes with ghostly dead flies lying in their bellies. Lucas Hansen, who always tried to trip him when he was going up the aisle. Sentences diagrammed on the blackboard. Beware the misplaced modifier. Petra Jesserling, who always wore A-line jumpers and had a crush on him, or so Mike Yanko claimed. The drone of Miss Avery's voice. Outs at noon, what would be plain old lunch in a plain old public school. Sitting at his desk afterward and trying to stay awake. Was that boy, that neat Piper schoolboy, actually going out to the north of a farming town called Calabrin Sturgis to battle child-stealing monsters? Could that boy be lying dead 36 hours from now, with his guts in a steaming pile behind him, blown out of his back and into the dirt by something called a sneech? Surely that wasn't possible, was it? The housekeeper, Mrs. Shaw, had cut the crusts off his sandwiches and sometimes called him Bama. His father had taught him how to calculate a 15% tip. Such boys surely did not go out to die with guns in their hands. Did they? I bet you get 20, Benny said. Boy, I wish I could be with you. We'd fight side by side. Pow, pow, pow. Then we'd reload. Jake sat up and looked at Benny with real curiosity. Would you? He asked. If you could? Benny thought about it. His face changed, was suddenly older and wiser. He shook his head. Nah, I'd be scared. Aren't you really scared? Say true. Scared to death, Jake said simply. Of dying? Yeah. But I'm even more scared of fucking up. You won't. Easy for you to say, Jake thought. If I have to go with the little kids, at least I'm glad my father's going too, Benny said. He's taking his bar. You ever seen him shoot? No. Well, he's good with it. If any of the wolves get past you guys, he'll take care of them. He'll find that gill place on their chests and pow! What if Benny knew the gill place was a lie? Jake wondered. False information this boy's father would hopefully pass on. What if he knew? Eddie spoke up in his head. Eddie, with his wise-ass Brooklyn accent in full flower. Yeah, and if fish had bicycles, every fucking river'd be the Tour de France. Benny, I really have to try to get some sleep. Benny lay back down. Jake did the same and resumed looking up at the ceiling. All at once he hated it that Oi was on Benny's bed, that Oi had taken so naturally to the other boy. All at once he hated everything about everything. The hours until morning, when he could pack, mount his borrowed pony, and ride back to town, seemed to stretch out into infinity. Jake? What, Benny, what? I'm sorry, I just wanted to say I'm glad you came here. We had some fun, didn't we? Yeah, Jake said, and thought, no one would believe he's older than me. He sounds about, I don't know, 5 or something. That was mean, but Jake had an idea that if he wasn't mean, he might actually start to cry. He hated Roland for sentencing him to this last night at the Rocking Bee. Yeah, fun big, big. I'm gonna miss you. But I'll bet they put up a statue of you guys in the pavilion or something. Guys was a word Benny had picked up from Jake, and he used it every chance he got. I'll miss you too, Jake said. You're lucky getting to follow the beam and travel places. I'll probably be here in this shitty town the rest of my life. No, you won't. You and your dad are going to do plenty of wandering, if you're lucky and they let you out of town, that is. What you're going to do, I think, is spend the rest of your life dreaming about this shitty little town, about a place that was home. And it's my doing. I saw and I told. But what else could I do? Jake? He could stand no more. It would drive him mad. Go to sleep, Benny, and let me go to sleep. Okay. Benny rolled over to face the wall. In a little while, his breathing slowed. A little while after that, he began snoring. Jake lay awake until nearly midnight, and then he went to sleep too, and had a dream. In it, Roland was down on his knees in the dust of East Road, facing a great horde of oncoming wolves that stretched from the bluffs to the river. He was trying to reload, but both of his hands were stiff and one was short 2 fingers. The bullets fell uselessly in front of him. He was still trying to load his great revolver. When the wolves
wrote him down. 13. Dawn of Wolf's Eve. Eddie and Susanna stood at the window of the pair's guest room, looking down the slope of lawn to Rosa's cottage.
"He's found something with her," Susanna said. "I'm glad for him."
Eddie nodded. "How you feeling?" She smiled up at him.
"I'm fine," she said, and meant it. "What about you, sugar?"
"I miss sleeping in a real bed with a roof over my head. And I'm anxious to get to it, but otherwise I'm fine, too.
Things go wrong, you won't have to worry about the accommodations."
"That's true," Eddie said.
"But I don't think they're going to go wrong, do you?"
Before she could answer, a gust of wind shook the house and whistled beneath the eaves. "The Seminon saying good day to you," Eddie guessed.
"I don't like that wind," she said. "It's a wild card."
Eddie opened his mouth.
"And if you say anything about Ka, I'll punch you in the nose."
Eddie closed his mouth again and mimed, zipping it shut. Susanna went to his nose anyway, a brief touch of knuckles like a feather.
"We've got a fine chance to win," she said. "They've had everything their own way for a long time, and it's made them fat, like Blaine."
"Yeah, like Blaine."
She put a hand on his hip and turned him to her.
"But things could go wrong, so I want to tell you something while it's just the two of us, Eddie. I want to tell you how much I love you."
She spoke simply with no drama.
"I know you do," he said, "but I'll be damned if I know why."
"Because you make me feel whole," she said. "When I was younger, I used to vacillate between thinking love was this great and glorious mystery and thinking it was just something a bunch of Hollywood movie producers made up to sell more tickets back in the Depression when Dish Night kind of played out."
Eddie laughed.
"Now I think that all of us are born with a hole in our hearts, and we go around looking for the person who can fill it. You, Eddie, you fill me up."
She took his hand and began to lead him back to the bed.
"And right now, I'd like you to fill me up the other way. Suze, is it safe?"
"I don't know," she said, "and I don't care."
They made love slowly, the pace only building near the end. She cried out softly against his shoulder, and in the instant before his own climax, blotted out reflection, Eddie thought, "I'm going to lose her if I'm not careful. I don't know how I know that, but I do. She'll just disappear."
"I love you too," he said, when they were finished and lying side by side again.
"Yes,"
she took his hand. "I know. I'm glad."
"It's good to make someone glad," he said. "I didn't used to know that."
"It's all right," Susanna said, and kissed the corner of his mouth. "You learn fast."
14. There was a rocker in Rosa's little living room. The gunslinger sat in it naked, holding a clay saucer in one hand. He was smoking and looking out at the sunrise. He wasn't sure he would ever again see it rise from this place. Rosa came out of the bedroom, also naked, and stood in the doorway looking at him.
"How are your bones? Tell me, I beg."
Roland nodded. "That oil of yours is a wonder."
"'Twon't last."
"No," Roland said. "But there's another world, my friend's world, and maybe they have something there that will. I've got a feeling we'll be going there soon."
"More fighting to do?"
"I think so, yes. You won't be back this way in any case, will you?" Roland looked at her. "No."
"Are you tired, Roland?"
"To death," said he.
"Come back to bed a little while then, will you not?"
He crushed out his smoke and stood. He smiled. It was a younger man's smile. "Say thank you.
Thee's a good man, Roland of Gilead."
He considered this, then slowly shook his head. "All my life I've had the fastest hands. But at being good, I was always a little too slow." She held out a hand to him.
"Come ye, Roland. Come, Kamala."
And he went to her. 15. Early that afternoon, Roland, Eddie, Jake, and Pear Callahan rode out the East Road, which was actually a North Road at this point along the winding Divar Titi Huai, with shovels concealed in the bedrolls at the backs of their saddles. Susanna had been excused from this duty on account of her pregnancy. She had joined the Sisters of Oriza at the pavilion, where a larger tent was being erected and preparations for a huge evening meal were already going forward. When they left, Calabrin Sturgis had already begun to fill up, as if for a fair day. But there was no whooping and hollering, no impudent rattle of firecrackers, no rides being set up on the green. They had seen neither Andy nor Ben Slightman, and that was good. "Tian?" Roland asked Eddie, breaking the rather heavy silence among them.
"He'll meet me at the rectory, 5 o'clock.
"Good," Roland said. "If we're not done out here by 4, you're excused to ride back on your own."
"I'll go with you if you like," Callahan said.
The Chinese believed that if you saved a man's life, you were responsible for him ever after. Callahan had never given the idea much thought, but after pulling Eddie back from the ledge above the doorway cave, it seemed to him there might be truth in the notion. "Better you stay with us," Roland said. "Eddie can take care of this. I've got another job for you out here. Besides digging, I mean."
"Oh, and what might that be?" Callahan asked.
Roland pointed at the dust devils, twisting and whirling ahead of them on the road. "Pray away this damned wind, and the sooner the better, before tomorrow morning, certainly."
"Are you worried about the ditch?" Jake asked.
"The ditch'll be fine," Roland said. "It's the Sisters Orizas I'm worried about. Throwing the plate is delicate work under the best of circumstances. If it's blowing up a gale out here when the wolves come, the possibilities for things to go wrong." He tossed his hand at the dusty horizon, giving it a distinctive and fatalistic collar twist. "De la." Callahan, however, was smiling.
"I'll be glad to offer a prayer," he said. "But look east before you grow too concerned, do ya, I beg?"
They turned that way in their saddles, corn, the crop now over, the picked plants, standing in sloping skeletal rows, ran down to the rice fields. Beyond the rice was the river. Beyond the river was the end of the borderlands. There, dust devils, 40 feet high, spun and jerked and sometimes collided. They made the ones dancing on their side of the river look like naughty children by comparison.
"The Seminon often reaches the Huai and then turns back," Callahan said. "According to the old folks, Lord Seminon begs Lady Oriza to make him welcome when he reaches the water, and she often bars his passage out of jealousy. You see,
Seminon married her Sissa," Jake said. "Lady Riza wanted him for herself, a marriage of wind and rice, and she's still PO'd about it."
"How did you know that?"
Callahan asked, both amused and astonished.
"Benny told me," Jake said, and said no more.
Thinking of their long discussions, sometimes in the hayloft, sometimes lazing on the bank of the river, and their eager exchanges of legend made him feel sad and hurt. Callahan was nodding.
"That's the story, all right. I imagine it's actually a weather phenomenon. Cold air over there, warm air rising off the water, something like that. But whatever it is, this one shows every sign of going back where it came from."
The wind dashed grit in his face, as if to prove him wrong, and Callahan laughed.
"This'll be over by first light tomorrow, I almost guarantee you, but—"
"Almost's not good enough, Pear."
"What I was going to say, Roland, is that since I know almost's not good enough, I'll gladly send up a prayer."
"Tell you thanks." The gunslinger turned to Eddie and pointed the first 2 fingers of his left hand at his own face. "The eyes, right?"
"The eyes," Eddie agreed. "And the password. If it's not 19, it'll be 99.
"You don't know that for sure."
"I know,"
Eddie said. "Still, be careful."
"I will."
A few minutes later, they reached the place where, on their right, a rocky track wandered off into the Arroyo country toward the Gloria and Redbirds 1 and 2. The Falcon assumed that the buckas would be left here, and they were correct. They also assumed that the children and their minders would then walk up the track to one mine or the other. In this, they were wrong. Soon three of them were digging on the west side of the road, a fourth always standing watch. No one came. The Falcon from this far out were already in town, and the work went quickly enough. At 4 o'clock, Eddie left the others to finish up and rode back to town to meet T. and Jeffords with one of Roland's revolvers holstered on his hip. 16. Tian had brought his ba. When Eddie told him to leave it on the pair's porch, the farmer gave him an unhappy, uncertain stare.
"He won't be surprised to see me packing iron, but he might have questions if he saw you with that thing," Eddie said.
This was it, the true beginning of their stand. And now that it had come, Eddie felt calm. His heart was beating slowly and steadily. His vision seemed to have clarified. He could see each shadow cast by each individual blade of grass on the rectory lawn.
"He's strong, from what I've heard, and very quick when he needs to be. Let it be my play." "Then why am I here?"
"Because even a smart robot wouldn't expect trouble if I've got a clodhopper like you with me," was the actual answer. "But giving it wouldn't be very diplomatic."
"Insurance," Eddie said. "Come on."
They walked down to the privy. Eddie had used it many times during the last few weeks, and always with pleasure. There were stacks of soft grasses for the clean-up phase, and you didn't have to concern yourself with poison flurry. But he'd not examined the outside closely until now. It was a wood structure, tall and solid, but he had no doubt Andy could demolish it in short order if he really wanted to. If they gave him a chance to. Rosa came to the back door of her cottage and looked out at them, holding a hand over her eyes to shield them from the sun.
"How do you, Eddie?"
"Fine so far, Rosie, but you better go back inside. There's going to be a scuffle."
"Say true. I've got a stack of plates."
"I don't think risers would help much in this case," Eddie said. "I guess it wouldn't hurt if you stood by, though."
She nodded and went back inside without another word. The men sat down, flanking the open door of the privy with its new bolt lock. Tian tried to roll a smoke. The first one fell apart in his shaking fingers, and he had to try again.
"I'm not good at this sort of thing," he said,
and Eddie understood he wasn't talking about the fine art of cigarette making.
"It's all right."
Tian peered at him hopefully.
"Do you say so?" "I do, so let it be so."
Promptly at 6 o'clock,
"The bastard's probably got a clock set right down to millions of a second inside him," Eddie thought.
Andy came around the rectory house, his shadow trailing out long and spidery on the grass in front of him. He saw them. His blue eyes flashed. He raised a hand in greeting. The setting sun reflected off his arm, making it look as though it had been dipped in blood. Eddie raised his own hand in return and stood up, smiling. He wondered if all the thinking machines that still worked in this run-down world had turned against their masters. And if so, why?
"Just be cool and let me do the talking," he said out of the corner of his mouth.
"Yes, all right."
"Eddie," Andy cried, "Tian Jeffords, how good to see you both, and weapons to use against the wolves. My, where are they?"
"Stacked in the shithouse," Eddie said.
"We can get a wagon down here once they're out, but they're heavy, and there isn't much room to move around in there."
He stood aside, and he came on. His eyes were flashing, but not in laughter now. They were so brilliant, Eddie had to squint. It was like looking at flashbulbs.
"I'm sure I can get them out," Andy said. "How good it is to help. How often I've regretted how little my programming allows me to."
He was standing in the privy door now, bent slightly at the thighs to get his metallic barrel of a head below the level of the jam. Eddie drew Roland's gun. As always, the sandalwood grip felt smooth and eager against his palm.
"Cry your pardon, Eddie of New York, but I see no guns."
"No," Eddie agreed. "Me either. Actually, all I see is a fucking traitor who teaches songs to the kids and then sends them to be—"
Andy turned with terrible liquid speed. To Eddie's ears, the hum of the servos in his neck seemed very loud.
They were standing less than 3 feet apart, point-blank range.
"May it do you fine, you stainless steel bastard," Eddie said, and fired twice. The reports were deafening in the evening stillness. Andy's eyes exploded and went dark. Tian cried out.
"No!"
Andy screamed in an amplified voice. It was so loud that it made the gunshots seem no more than popping corks by comparison.
"No, my eyes! I can't see! Oh, no! Vision zero! My eyes! My eyes!"
The scrawny stainless steel arms flew up to the shattered sockets, where blue sparks were now jumping erratically. Andy's legs straightened, and his barrel of a head ripped through the top of the privy's doorway, throwing chunks of board left and right.
"No, no, no! I can't see! Vision zero! What have you done to me? Ambush! Attack! I'm blind! Code 7! Code 7! Code 7!"
"Help me push him, Tian!" Eddie shouted, dropping the gun back into its holster, but Tian was frozen. Gawking at the robot, whose head had now vanished inside the broken doorway, and Eddie had no time to wait. He lunged forward and planted his outstretched palms on the plate giving Andy's name, function, and serial number. The robot was amazingly heavy. Eddie's first thought was that it was like pushing a parking garage, but it was also blind, surprised, and off balance. It stumbled backward, and suddenly the amplified words cut off. What replaced them was an unearthly shrieking siren. Eddie thought it would split his head. He grabbed the door and swung it shut. There was a huge, ragged gap at the top, but the door still closed flush. Eddie ran the new bolt, which was as thick as his wrist. From within the privy, the siren shrieked and warbled. Rosa came running with a plate in both hands. Her eyes were huge.
"What is it? In the name of God and the man Jesus, what is it?"
Before Eddie could answer, a tremendous blow shook the privy on its foundations. It actually moved to the right, disclosing the edge of the hole beneath it.
"It's Andy," he said. "I think he just pulled up a horoscope he doesn't much care for."
"You bastards!" This voice was totally unlike Andy's usual three forms of address. Smarmy, self-satisfied, or falsely subservient.
"You bastards! Cousining bastards! I'll kill you! I'm blind, oh! I'm blind! Code 7! Code 7!"
The words ceased, and the siren recommenced. Rosa dropped her plates and clapped her hands over her ears. Another blow slammed against the side of the privy, and this time two of the stout boards bowed outward. The next one broke them. Andy's arm flashed through, gleaming red in the light, the four jointed fingers at the end opening and closing spasmodically. In the distance, Eddie could hear the crazy barking of dogs.
"He's going to get out, Eddie," Tian shouted, grabbing Eddie's shoulder. "He's going to get out!"
Eddie shook the hand off and stepped to the door. There was another crashing blow. More broken boards popped off the side of the privy. The lawn was scattered with them now, but he couldn't shout against the wail of the siren. It was just too loud. He waited, and before Andy hammered the side of the privy again, it cut off.
"Bastards!" Andy screamed. "I'll kill you, Directive 20, Code 7. I'm blind, zero vision, you cowardly—"
"Andy, messenger robot!"
Eddie shouted. He had jotted the serial number on one of Callahan's precious scraps of paper with Callahan's stub of pencil, and now he read it off.
DNF-34821-V-63. Password.
The frenzied blows and amplified shouting ceased as soon as Eddie finished giving the serial number, yet even the silence wasn't silent. His ears still rang with the hellish shriek of the siren. There was a clank of metal and the click of relays. Then,
"This is DNF-34821-V-63. Please give password."
A pause, and then tonelessly,
"You ambushing bastard, Eddie Dean of New York. You have 10 seconds. 9.
19,
Eddie said through the door.
"Incorrect password."
And tin man or not, there was no mistaking the furious pleasure in Andy's voice.
8, 7,
99.
"Incorrect password."
Now what Eddie heard was triumph. He had time to regret his insane cockiness out on the road, time to see the look of terror which passed between Rosa and Tian, time to realize the dogs were still barking.
5, 4,
not 19, not 99. What else was there? What in the name of Christ turned the bastard off?
3.
What flashed into his mind, as bright as Andy's eyes had been before Roland's big revolver turned them dark, was the verse, scrawled on the fence around the vacant lot, spray-painted in dusty rose-pink letters. Oh, Susanna Mio, divided girl of mine, done parked her rig in the Dixie Pig in the year of 2. Not one or the other, both. Which was why the damned robot hadn't cut him off after a single incorrect try. He hadn't been incorrect, not exactly. 1999. Eddie screamed through the door. From behind it, utter silence. Eddie waited for the siren to start up again. Waited for Andy to resume bashing his way out of the privy. He'd tell Tian and Rosa to run, try to cover them. The voice that spoke from inside the battered building was colorless and flat. The voice of a machine. Both the fake smarminess and the genuine fury were gone. Andy, as generations of Kalafokan had known him, was gone, and for good. "Thank you," the voice said. "I am Andy, a messenger robot, many other functions. Serial number DNF-34821-V-63. How may I help?"
"By shutting yourself down." Silence from the privy. "Do you understand what I'm asking?"
A small, horrified voice said,
"Please don't make me. You bad man. Oh, you bad man.
Shut yourself down, now."
A longer silence. Rosa stood with her hand pressed against her throat. Several men appeared around the side of the pair's house, armed with various homely weapons. Rosa waved them back.
DNF-34821-V-63, comply.
"Yes, Eddie of New York, I will shut myself down."
A horrible, self-pitying sadness had crept into Andy's new small voice. It made Eddie's skin crawl.
"Andy is blind and will shut down. Are you aware that with my main power cells 98% depleted, I may never be able to power up again?"
Eddie remembered the vast Runt twins out of the Jaffords smallhold, Tia and Zalman, and then thought of all the others like them this unlucky town had known over the years. He dwelled particularly on the Tavery twins, so bright and quick and eager to please. And so beautiful.
"Never won't be long enough," he said. "But I guess it'll have to do. Palaver's done, Andy. Shut down."
Another silence from within the half-busted privy. Tian and Rosa crept up to either side of Eddie, and the three of them stood together in front of the locked door. Rosa gripped Eddie's forearm. He shook her off immediately. He wanted his hand free, in case he had to draw. Although, where he would shoot now that Andy's eyes were gone, he didn't know. When Andy spoke again, it was in a toneless, amplified voice that made Tian and Rosa gasp and step back. Eddie stayed where he was. He had heard a voice like this and words like this once before, in the clearing of the Great Bear. Andy's rap wasn't quite the same, but close enough for government work.
DNF-34821-V-63 is shutting down. All subnuclear cells and memory circuits are in shutdown phase. Shutdown is 13% complete. I am Andy, messenger robot, many other functions. Please report my location to Lemurk Industries or North Central Positronics Limited. Call 1-900-54. Reward is offered. Repeat, reward is offered.
There was a click as the message recycled.
DNF-34821-V-63 is shutting down. All subnuclear cells and memory circuits are in shutdown phase. Shutdown is 19% complete. I am Andy.
You were Andy, Eddie said softly. He turned to Tian and Rosa and had to smile at their scared children's faces. It's all right, he said. It's over. He'll go on blaring like that for a while and then he'll be done. You can turn him into a planter or something.
I think we'll tear up the floor and bury him right there, Rosa said, nodding at the privy.
Eddie's smile widened and became a grin. He liked the idea of burying Andy in shit.
He liked that idea very well.